Chapter 7, in this book at least, is about bone tissue. Now notice that we skip the chapter in here that's called the skeletal system, because that chapter is really about the specific bones of the skeleton, and that's what we do in lab, so that's not a lecture thing. Here we're talking about the actual makeup of bones in general, not what the names of the individual bones are. And in this opening slide, we're seeing basically the same bone, but in the living version on the left and in the dried on the right. And when we look at bones, at least those of us who aren't bone surgeons, we usually are looking at a dried bone. You know, if you're looking, usually you don't see bones at all. If you do see bones in a laboratory class, even if they're real bones, they're going to be dried. And that only includes some of the actual bone, of what we call the whole bone. It only includes the hard parts, basically. And that might give you the false impression that bones are produced, hardened, and then they're permanent structures. But that's not true of any part of the body, really, like I said. All structures of a living organism are dynamic, so they're always changing, including the bones. The bones are always undergoing some degradation, some building, some maintenance. So the bone that you, your femur that you had when it became mature, which is actually right about now for most of your ages. That's not going to be the same bone in 10 years. Even though it seems like it's the same size and everything, it's made of different stuff because it's been changed over many times. So on the living part on the left, let's look at the general anatomy. Unless you cut into a bone, all you're going to see is really just a covering, not even bony material at all. You're going to see a covering called the periosteum. That periosteum is mostly connective tissue. Now keep in mind that bone itself is connective tissue, but it's a different type of connective tissue. Periosteum gets its name because ost means bone, peri means around. So it's a sheath, a connective tissue sheath, that wraps around the exterior surface of the living bone. And notice the little flap that is been taken away so that you can see just periosteum by itself. Gives you a better view of the fact that running through the periosteum are blood vessels and neurons, nerves. Just underlying that is the hard stuff. And back in the chapter in which we surveyed the different types of tissue, I said that there are two major types of bone, right? Compact bone and spongy bone, which can also be called cancellous bone. Well, if you were to remove the periosteum and look at a bone, the only type of bone you would see, unless you saw it into it, would be the compact bone. So compact bone is always the externally placed type of bone, but any given bone is made up of both compact and cancellous bone. And compact is a good descriptor because there are very few spaces in compact bone. It doesn't have porosity. It's not full of holes. There are tiny, tiny passageways in it, which I'll talk about in a minute. But I mean, compared to the major spaces that we see in cancellous bone, compact bone doesn't have those. And that's those major spaces is exactly why cancellous bone is called spongy bone. But it doesn't at all mean that you can wring it out like a sponge. It's still hard stuff. It just looks like a sponge, and that's the only reason it's called that. Well, the spongy bone is found deep to the compact bone. So the compact bone, which is much tougher, of course, because it has a lot more solid in it, that is a superficial wrapping around interiorly placed spongy bone or cancellous bone. And there are, we can classify roughly at least bones into different shapes. For instance, the one we're looking at here, which is a femur, the largest bone in a human, it's classified as a long bone. Some bones are long bones because they are simply elongated in one direction. Some bones are classified as flat bones, like the scapula, for instance, is a flat bone. So are the parietal bones of the skull that make up the sides of the cranium. Those are flat bones. Some bones are short bones, like the patella, for instance, or the kneecap. So they are roughly circular or square in shape. They're not elongated in one direction compared to the other. And then some bones just have to go in the miscellaneous category because they don't fit any of those other three. And so those are called irregular bones. Like the sphenoid bone of the skull, for instance, is a good example of an irregular bone. But don't worry about the individual bones in here. We'll talk about that in lab. Anyway, we're looking at a long bone right here. And a long bone, in general, has as most of its length what is called a diaphysis. It's labeled on the right. And then at the tip, at least one tip, and often, as in this case, at both tips, there is an epiphysis. So notice there's an epiphysis at the top and there's an epiphysis labeled at the bottom here. So the diaphysis is the shaft, and the epiphyses are at the ends. They're at the tips. But both of these parts are really compact bone covering up spongy bone, at least to some degree. Now, as a bone matures, it will hollow out to a certain degree along the diaphysis, which is why you have plenty of room for yellow marrow in here in what's labeled the marrow cavity. This is a mature bone. It started out not having that much space in there, but it hollowed out as part of its development. And hollowing out, it not only allows for marrow to be housed in that medullary cavity, but it's also good from a, if you were thinking about designing a body, it would be good to have tubular bones rather than rod bones. Why is that? They're lighter for a given dimension. Right? I mean, if you have a solid bone and you just make it wider but keep it solid, it's going to be even heavier, right? It will be stronger than a tube of that same diameter, but it's going to weigh a lot more. And the more it weighs, the harder it is to move around, the more energy it's going to take. On the other hand, the greater the diameter is, the better able it's able to withstand shear forces from the side. Something that's trying to bend it, right? If you have a narrow rod, it's easy to bend because when you do that, one side is being compressed and the other side is being expanded whenever you bend it. And the narrower the diameter, the smaller the distances that the compression travels and the expansion travels. You make it a bigger diameter and bend it to the same angle, there's going to be a hell of a lot of compression on this side and a lot of stretching on this side. And that's why a tube, which can weigh the same as a rod that's smaller diameter, will be stronger than a rod of smaller diameter, because it's harder to bend something with a larger diameter because you have to compress more and stretch more to do that. And this is exactly why eventually they realized that in bike construction and started making the bike frames big tubes, big hollow tubes that are light but still very hard to bend because of their diameter. And so it's not just a matter of making room for marrow. It's all about making the skeleton strong enough, but also light enough to be manageable. Now, speaking of marrow, there are two types, and those are called yellow marrow and red marrow. Yellow marrow is really just stored fat. Red marrow, on the other hand, is hemopoietic tissue. Hemopoietic is H-E-M-O-P-O-I-E-T-I-C. And it's just, hemopoietic is just the adjective of hemopoiesis, which is the process of producing blood cells. All right? So, blood cells are created in red marrow from stem cells that make up the bulk of the red marrow. Why does it make sense that they are stem cells? Why does that make sense for blood? Because there are different kinds of blood cells. They all come from the same kind of stem cells. In fact, they're called hemopoietic stem cells. So all the different kinds of white blood cells, plus all the erythrocytes, which are the red blood cells, those all come from the same exact kind of hemopoietic stem cells in red blood. I mean, in red marrow. And then they develop differently depending on which way they're, which path they're signaled to go in. All right, so that's where your new blood cells are born, in a sense. And this is happening throughout life because, like I said, you lose billions of red blood cells every day simply because they've worn out. They've seen better days. They've spent their days squeezing through these capillaries that are even smaller than they are. They don't have a nucleus. They can't repair themselves. They get filtered by the spleen largely and thrown out and replaced by the ones that are coming from the red marrow. All right, so those two types of marrow fill in what in a dry bone is space. Well, it's only space in the dead condition. In the living human, though, what you see as spaces in a dry bone are filled with marrow of one type or another. And as you see here in an adult, the two kinds of marrow occupy different chambers. And we'll talk more about where the different types of marrow are in the overall skeleton a little bit later. Now, notice this epiphyseal line that's listed here. The epiphyseal line is the boundary between the epiphysis and the diaphysis. And when it's called an epiphyseal line, it is ossified. It is bony material. It's hard. And it's no longer, and that bone is no longer growing in length. So by the time the epiphyseal line ossifies, which is right about 20 or so, then you've reached your stature. You're not going to grow anymore, at least as far as your skeleton is concerned. All right? So however tall you've gotten by the time that epiphyseal line is ossified, that's as tall as you're going to get. But if we looked at this bone in an earlier stage of this human, it would be called an epiphyseal plate. And it would not be made of bone yet. It would be made of cartilage. And there would be actively dividing cells producing more bone eventually on either side. And so it would allow for the diaphysis to grow in length and the epiphysis to grow away from it. So that would allow for the bone to elongate. That only happens up to a certain age. So we'll talk about that bone growth later as well. But while we're still on this slide, Let me talk about the articular cartilage. Articular cartilage, of course, is cartilage, and I even talked about articular cartilage a little bit when we were in the tissues chapter. It's called articular cartilage because the name for a joint is articulation. Where two bones come together is an articulation. And when two bones come together but also move with respect to each other, because not all joints are movable, in other words, at a movable joint, the surfaces of the bone that would otherwise be in direct contact at that joint are coated by articular cartilage as a shock absorber and as a lubricator. It allows for much freer movement, much less friction between the two surfaces, than there would be if you had bone right on bone between the two ones that forming the joint. All right, so articular cartilage remains cartilage throughout life, although it degrades as we age, and sometimes it does get to the point of bone to bone. But articular cartilage remains as cartilage throughout life. On the other hand, this whole bone started out as cartilage in the young human, and it gets ossified. It turns into bone as part of development. Well, the articular cartilage never does turn into bone. It remains as cartilage. But we'll talk about the bone development in another time as well. So I'll stop there today.